This episode of The Sweaty Penguin is brought to you by Real Crocodiles. Do you wish looking at an animal didn't make you immediately think of singer-songwriter Shawn Mendes? Try Real Crocodiles today.
COP28 did bring more good news than I expected, but it also left some pretty big question marks, and I'll give you a hint, it rhymes with Shmouty Shmarabia. Happy Friday, I'm Ethan Brown, and this is Tip of the Iceberg, where I will break down some environmental news and then answer a question from our listeners on the air. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. The United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP28, wrapped up in the United Arab Emirates about a month ago. Perfectly timed during the week I was packing to move back to Connecticut from Los Angeles, and then it was the holidays, so I wouldn't be able to cover it then. Like, seriously, Sultan Al-Jaber, couldn't you reschedule? The conference convened a record 84,000 people, including world leaders and delegates from all 195 countries. The initial plan was to break the Guinness World Record for the largest gathering of people standing on one foot, but instead they ended up assessing global progress on climate change and forming international agreements to spur further action. Not quite as productive, but we'll take it. And even though I was talking about being pessimistic in the lead-up, there were actually quite a few pieces of good news that came out of the event. On the first day, they operationalized the Loss and Damage Fund, which will help developing countries cope with the impacts of climate change they cannot mitigate or adapt to. For example, the costs of rebuilding infrastructure that has been damaged due to a flood, or the loss of revenue from crops that were destroyed due to drought. Several countries made contributions to the fund at COP28, bringing the piggy bank up to $700 million. This is also the budget my friend Keith has. His parents pay his rent. He's a consultant. The conference also resulted in $3.5 billion in new pledges to the Green Climate Fund, mobilized nearly $500 million in new climate financing for urban infrastructure, raised another billion for methane action, agreed to some climate adaptation targets, saw 159 countries sign a declaration on sustainable agriculture, and secured new funding capacity and financing mechanisms for forest and land protection. You still with me? Name all the good COP28 news in 5 seconds, go. I don't care that you're on the subway and a creepy guy is staring at you, do it. And if all that wasn't enough, in the final agreement signed by all 195 countries dubbed the UAE Consensus, the whole world agreed to triple global renewable energy capacity by 2030, accelerate efforts toward the phase down of unabated coal power, phase out fossil fuel subsidies that do not address energy poverty, and the most newsworthy part, the whole world agreed to a, quote, transition away from fossil fuels and energy systems in a just, orderly, and equitable manner, accelerating action in this critical decade so as to achieve net zero by 2050 in keeping with the science. End quote. To be fair, this transition is already happening. It's like if I declared I'm transitioning away from watching Blue's Clues. Like, I'm 24, this transition started a while ago. I'm not saying I never watch Blue's Clues, obviously, just that it's less than before. But even though the transition away from fossil fuels is underway, it's still really significant to get every country in the world to sign a declaration calling for it. It sets a direction for countries and companies figuring out future plans. It enables more international accountability if you can remind countries down the line that they agreed to that. And it looks really good on the delegates' moms' fridges. Last I heard, all the delegates received stickers with a picture of a giraffe saying way to go on them, so pretty big deal. So that's the good news, and it is good news. But what was left unanswered, and this is a massive thing to leave unanswered, is who's paying for developing countries to transition away from fossil fuels? Paris Hilton? My friend Keith? According to Sustainable Energy for All, more than 750 million people in the world lack access to electricity, and over 2.5 billion people don't have access to clean cooking technologies or fuels. In these regions, the goal is simply affordable energy in any shape or form. And Ritz crackers. Let's not leave them out. What energy source would that be? Based on some recent investigative reporting, we know a little bit more about what Saudi Arabia has in mind. In 2020, they launched what they call in English the Oil Sustainability Program, which is a little bit of an oxymoron. It's like if I created the Cargo Pants Fashionability Program or the Hawaiian Pizza Deliciousness Program. In reality, the Saudi program actually better translates to the Oil Demand Sustainability Program. And to find out what it is, a team of undercover reporters from the Center for Climate Reporting and Channel 4 News actually went and posed as potential investors and had a meeting with Saudi officials. And I think you can imagine how that went.
Hello, are you two the investors?
Yeah, totally. We're investors.
Yeah, stocks and bonds and whatever.
Good. Shall we jump in?
Well, we should get to know each other first, right? Like, how about those Knicks?
What are you doing?
I like to build a personal relationship with my, my investing clients.
Oh, smart. Hey, how's the weather in Saudi Arabia? I could go for some of your weather. It's pretty chilly here in the investing office.
Can we get started?
Okay, well, answer me this. Do you like oil?
Of course I like oil.
Ha! You got her!
Oh, my dude, you just got pranked! Bet you didn't see that one coming, huh?
Okay, fine. That wasn't how it happened. And not just because our skit was all women. We kind of have a reverse Saturday Night Live situation going on over here. I know it's not groundbreaking that the Saudis like oil, but the undercover reporters gathered a lot of really important information during their investigation. It was really great work. What they found is this oil demand sustainability program aims to drive up the use of fossil fuel-powered cars, buses, and planes in Africa and elsewhere in order to hook developing countries onto fossil fuel infrastructure and guarantee future demand for oil, which the Saudis can then sell them. Among the plans are promoting the use of power ships, which are essentially floating power plants that can plug into electric grids and provide energy, partnering with a car maker to come up with a really cheap model with internal combustion engines, and developing supersonic air travel, which they noted they were excited about because it would use 3 times the amount of jet fuel that conventional air travel uses. Not to be confused with supersonic air travel, where you lift off really fast and then immediately crash land in the ocean. But to be fair, gotta go fast.
Gotta go fast! Gotta go fast! Gotta go faster, 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 faster!
On the one hand, this plan is ridiculously frustrating. It's like a coffee shop selling you an espresso machine for $1, but the only compatible coffee pods are filled with liquid gold and unicorn tears. My friend Keith has them. Mohamed Addo, the director of PowerShift Africa, compared it to a drug dealer trying to hook an addict on their harmful product. And honestly, I kind of agree. It also frustrates me from the perspective of developing countries who would end up reliant on global oil markets, which are ridiculously volatile and create more costs in the long run, And it frustrates me from the perspective of the people of Saudi Arabia, which, as we covered in our Gabar oil field episode, is on track to be too hot to inhabit by 2070 and needs rapid climate action as much as anyone in the world. And yet, with the current international accountability system the way it is, Saudi Arabia is kind of on to something. First off, signing a document calling for a transition away from fossil fuels doesn't really bind them to anything. There's no world police or world Paw Patrol enforcing any of these declarations. But even if they did, when countries report their carbon emissions to the world, they are reporting what are called Scope 1 emissions. To understand what that means, let's do a quick review from our episodes on carbon neutrality and carbon accounting. Carbon accountants are supposed to track three types of carbon emissions, categorized into scopes 1, 2, and 3. Scope 1 accounts for all on-site emissions. For a company, that might be things like gas boilers, air conditioning leaks, on-site company-owned vehicles, and Tina from Human Resources, who eats bean salad for lunch and lets it rip all afternoon. She can't get fired. She's Human Resources. Scope 2 accounts for indirect energy emissions, mainly electricity. Why is electricity indirect? Well, let's say you run an office building. Most of the time, you're not actually burning coal or natural gas on site. I heard NBC is making their production assistants do this now, though. They're getting coffee, and then they have to go shovel coal into a furnace to power Al Roker. But everywhere else, it's being burned at a power plant, and then the electricity comes to you via power lines. As a result, it's technically the power plant that emitted the carbon, so it's scope 1 for them, but you obviously had a little something to do with those emissions too, since they powered your building. As such, there's scope 1 for the power plant, but scope 2 for you. And then there's scope 3, which accounts for all other indirect emissions from an entity's activities. This includes the emissions from people driving to work, the construction of the materials in the office, the emissions later in the supply chain from the products you sell, the emissions from Tina's bean salad when she's not in the office, but at an HR convention, basically every other emission that resulted in the supply chain because of a transaction made by that entity. This is really hard to calculate and track. It's like that one randomly way too difficult math problem on every test as a kid that you wasted half the time on. But it's also by far the largest category of emissions for most companies, and important to track since it also offers the most opportunity for emissions reductions. When we talk about countries on the world stage, though, we're only talking about Scope 1 emissions. The COP conferences are only a week or two. They barely even have time to talk about Emily in Paris. Which means if Saudi Arabia sells oil to, say, Rwanda, who they signed an agreement with in November, the emissions from that oil would count against Rwanda, not Saudi Arabia. That's because the oil itself would be burned in Rwanda, and for them would be Scope 1. For Saudi Arabia, these are Scope 3 emissions. Yes, it's their oil, but since the emissions happen later in the supply chain, they can dodge responsibility when everyone reports their emissions. They can even duck, dip, and dive if they want to, thanks to the great Patches O'Houlihan. And with these developing countries facing energy poverty, it's a lot harder for developed countries to complain on the world stage about their emissions going up. They've historically not been high emitters, they really need the energy, and so the United States, European Union, and others have zero moral high ground with which to hold them accountable. Nor should they, because they do need affordable energy. It's like car insurance or Stanley Cups, you just have to have it. And from the perspective of developing countries, sure, solar and wind and nuclear and energy efficiency are awesome. They're obviously sitting with Regina George. But even though these technologies save significant money in the long run, they take a pretty substantial upfront investment to get going. The UN has tried to address this through something called the Green Climate Fund, which I mentioned before, received $3.5 billion in new pledges at COP28. Alpha Apple Pi also received billions of dollars when they got their new pledges. One was Keith. But this is a drop in the bucket when it comes to the investment needed to actually get clean energy up and running in all these countries. Not to mention, there have been several times where Green Climate Fund grants were misallocated toward fossil fuel projects. And they knew it wasn't just because ExxonMobil broke in and robbed the cash register. Wealthier countries and/or their private sectors are probably the ones best suited to make these investments in setting up clean energy infrastructure. And again, given the economic competitiveness of clean energy, it's more of a business opportunity than anything else. Wealthier countries could pony up public funds, or they could create policies that incentivize private investors to pursue clean energy partnerships in developing countries. Either way, it's a win for the investor, a win for the developing country, and a win for the climate. It's like those little fish that clean the teeth of bigger fish. Wins all around. As much as all that sounds like a no-brainer, like how the reason Taylor dropped Travis back in Kansas City but didn't stay with him was because she has a life outside of him, investment in clean energy in developing countries actually has to happen. And very little of COP28 actually solidified that. Financing fell short. Countries are still only responsible for their Scope 1 emissions. And in fact, that framework has already led to some greenwashing. At COP28, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia unveiled a charter that committed participating fossil fuel companies to reach net zero emissions by 2050, but only for Scope 1. This, again, excludes emissions from the oil and gas they sell, which is almost all of their emissions. It's like hiring a private chef, making zero plans about who's going to do the dishes, and then telling your roommate you'll do every single dish that you cook with. Like, that looks fair on paper, but you caused the foie gras pan to get dirty. That needs to be part of your plan, too. There are ways to hold countries accountable at these conferences. It can actually be really effective in negotiations for high emitters to have to look delegates from island countries in the eyes and hear their pain as the climate crisis threatens their nation's existence. But telling on Saudi Arabia to mommy and daddy at UN conferences only gets us so far. At a certain point, the United States, the European Union, even China for better or worse, need to hit up the developing countries that Saudi Arabia is going to, present clean energy partnerships, and outcompete them for the sake of the climate and everybody's economies. I know they have Cristiano Ronaldo, but we have Lionel Messi. We can do this. The financing issue will no doubt be a big star of next year's COP29 in Azerbaijan, but we also can't wait until then to start pursuing these opportunities. It's a lot harder to get these clean energy deals done if oil-based infrastructure from Saudi Arabia beats us to the punch. Again, there was a lot of good news out of COP28, more than I expected. But while it's awesome that Saudi Arabia signed on to a transition away from fossil fuels, we can't let that distract from their plan to hook developing nations on oil and likely be able to evade responsibility through a carbon accounting loophole. So let's be sure to hold them accountable to the agreement they signed on to, outcompete them with clean energy opportunities for developing nations, and maybe get it all bankrolled by Keith. And now, here's Emma with the news.
Hey there, I'm Emma, and this is your weekly update. The U.S. Interior Department, which is not a new hit HGTV show, has approved of the Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind Project, which is set to become the nation's largest offshore wind farm, with up to 176 turbines, and will double as the nation's largest suicide forest for birds. Just kidding. House cats actually cause over 1,000 times more bird deaths than wind turbines do. The more you know. Developed by Dominion Energy, the project aims to generate 2.6 gigawatts of electricity, enough to travel through time in the DeLorean twice, or over 900,000 homes, whichever one sounds coolest to you, I guess. The project is expected to be completed by 2026, 1 year after the McDonald's snack wrap is set to return. No relation. The project plans to mitigate environmental impacts, including relocating turbines from fish habitats and compensating fisheries for potential losses, which is honestly really going to disrupt the underwater mini golf course they were planning on building. The Kenya Nut Company, which is not an adult site with a clever name, is said to become the world's first farm to produce its own sustainable fertilizer through a partnership with U.S. climate tech startup Talus Renewables. I imagine it to be exactly like Stardew Valley. Under a 15-year agreement, Talus will provide green ammonia, a key component in nitrogen-based fertilizers, producing an innovative hydrogen-to-fertilizer process that leverages electricity from solar farms. Try saying innovative hydrogen-to-fertilizer process 5 times fast. A day in the life of their CEO, I'm guessing. This method, which produces ammonia by splitting hydrogen from water and combining it with atmospheric nitrogen, significantly reduces the carbon intensity of ammonia production and gets into some real Bill Nye-shes. This locally produced green ammonia will reduce both the carbon footprint and cost for farmers, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, enhancing food security, improving energy independence, and getting rid of our previous source of ammonia. Your mom. Get in, losers, we're going to visit the U.S. national parks. For free! You heard that right. Everyone's father who peeked in Eagle Scouts, the U.S. National Park Service has announced that in 2024, you will have 6 chances throughout the year to enter and explore any of the U.S. national parks. The only thing you'll have to pay for is gas, raincoats, a gallon of sunscreen that you will forget at home, and the inevitable emotional damage you will endure trying to get just one goddamn family photo that you will cherish forever and never stop talking about. Oh my god, Sharon, you've never been to the Redwood National Forest? Never? It's life-changing, Sharon. I came out a different person, truly. Makes you realize how small we are all on this blue little orb. I mean, birds don't even have access to the internet. Why should I?
Do you find yourself not being able to stop talking about all the behind-the-scenes info about Lyle Crocodile, like how Lyle was supposed to originally be voiced by Bruno Mars? Then Real Crocodiles are for you. By supporting Real Crocodiles, you can help shed light on the stories of crocodiles all over the world. Like Jeffrey, he can bowl a perfect 300 and bake a mean ratatouille. But you wouldn't know, because every time you see him, you just sing to yourself, la 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 la. So please, take just 2 minutes out of your day to support the loving and talented individuals of the croc community. Like Todd, he loves model trains. Real crocodiles. Lyle who?
Welcome back to Tip of the Iceberg. It's time for Ask Me Anything, where our listeners get a chance to ask me any environmental questions they may have. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. To kick off 2024, we've got an in-house question from one of our team members. Megan Antone asks, why can't we just make new plastic out of old plastic entirely? I consistently see water bottles and plastic bags that say things like 15% recycled plastic or 40% recycled plastic. Why can't everything just be 100% and then we have less plastic waste? Thanks so much for the question, Megan. I really like this one, and you're totally right. That would be ideal. Now, I'm pretty optimistic, so I'd like to think it could be possible someday to have plastic products come from 100% recycled materials, but I can answer why it isn't at the moment, and there's a few reasons. One, the demand for plastic is through the roof. Plastic production is currently on pace to triple globally by 2060, and there's a whole lot of companies pushing to keep things moving in that direction, because plastic, believe it or not, is made from fossil fuels. We talk all the time about carbon bombs on here. A lot of that same oil and gas we're pulling out of the ground for energy is also being used to make plastic. And regardless of what they might say publicly, these companies know that oil and gas aren't going to be able to compete with clean energy much longer. So for them, a really easy pivot is making plastic, and a lot of it. And since we're all finding ways to use this plastic, they're keeping it coming. Not only is it difficult to fill all that demand with recycled plastic, but the fossil fuel companies then get no money for drilling and fracking to get the materials to make new plastic. So that's one issue. Two, on the flip side, very little plastic actually gets recycled. Only around 9% of annual plastic waste gets recycled, and there's several reasons why. Probably most significant, people just don't recycle a lot of the time. But we also often contaminate our recycling with either non-recyclable plastic or plastic that has food residue or what have you, which makes it non-recyclable. And on top of that, there are 7 different grades of plastic, and they are largely incompatible with each other. Sorting through all that is costly, and certainly not something individuals have the time or capacity to do. Ultimately, this creates a situation where virgin plastic, or brand new plastic, is really cheap, and recycled plastic is really expensive. And it's unfortunate, because if you factor in the environmental costs, which are real costs, not just plastic in the ocean, but the actual drilling and fracking for fossil fuels, then recycling is a lot more appealing. Now, I think recycling will get cheaper, we'll find better ways to do it, and hopefully we'll do it more, especially if consumers are vocal about the fact that they want more recycled plastic. But in the meantime, it really does come back to the 3 R's we learned in grade school: reduce, reuse, recycle, in that order. Reducing plastic use has the most positive impact. If we have to use it, reusing it is a lot better than buying new every single time. And once we do dispose of it, recycling correctly is ideal, but again, it depends on the grade of plastic, it often depends on what your locality can manage, and it still has a bit to go to become as economically viable as we would hope. Thanks so much for the question, Megan, and thanks to everyone for listening to Tip of the Iceberg. Take 2 minutes, help out the show, and get a shout-out at the end of the show by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple or Podcast Addict. Special thanks to our Emperor Penguin patrons, Lawrence Harris and Brownies Central. Thank you all for listening, and I'll see you next week for a deep dive on sugar.